We also have the executive director from IFED, who might also be on the platform at this point in time, and or officials from the independent police investigative directorate that might be on the platform. Well, members, we're having a back-on-back meeting. First we'll be engaging the National Prosecuting Authority, and then we'll be engaging the Independent Police Investigative Directorate in terms of the time we scheduled this afternoon. But be that as it may, we'll be beginning with the proofs of our engagement with the National Prosecuting Authority. Well, welcome once again to officials of the NPA. Perhaps just to indicate that this meeting is taking at a time when the National Council of Provinces has scheduled a week of oversight from the 16th to the 20th of August under the theme Mitigating the Impact of COVID-19 and the Recent Looting, Violence and Destruction. And this will also be followed by a debate in the National Council of Provinces on the 25th of August 2021. But as part of this oversight program, we undertook to meet with the NPA to understand the extent that the recent civil unrest in South Africa has had on the department's caseload, but further to understand the efforts to mitigate the impact of COVID-19 within the NPA. So in terms of today's meeting, we would want to understand from the National Prosecuting Authority an overview of the cases and their operations in relation to the unrest, coordination and cooperation with the South African police services and other relevant structures, their action plan moving forward for prosecutions and convictions, challenges and lessons that they've learned in the process, and the impact of COVID-19 obviously on their staff, as well as an update on in terms of vaccinations of NPA staff, right? I think with that said, I'm going to hand over to the National Director to take us through their presentation. And thereafter, honorable members will then engage on that presentation. National Director, can you please take over?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, and thank you for the invitation to the NPA to brief this select committee on the issues that you have just outlined. I should mention at this point that I am joined with members of the team in the NPA. Advocate Rodney de Kock is the Deputy National Director in charge of the National Prosecution Service, and he is with me on this platform together with members of his team. Advocate Omar Rabaji Rasataba unfortunately has another crisis that she, as a result, she's not here. She's the head of our asset forfeiture unit, but she is represented on the platform by members of her team. Honourable Chair, you know, as I mentioned to the Portfolio Committee when we appeared before them 2.5 years ago already, when I took office in 2019 of February, the NPA was already, like many other state institutions, reeling from 10 years of serious weakening. Caseload was extremely high at that stage, vacancy rates. And then within, you know, the next year, we were already, so there was a process of building, and then we were hit by COVID. And then, of course, following that, we were then the corruption, the added corruption, the PPE corruptions following COVID then hit us. And all of that again lands up on the justice system and the prosecuting authority. And now we have the unrest that really rocked the foundation of our constitutional democracy. And it almost feels as if just when we've got a plan, and you'll hear a lot about it, but it feels like as you're getting your head above the water, you've got something else, just like an avalanche comes crashing down, and it just keeps building up. But we have to be resilient, and we've got to have plans, and we've got to deal with these issues as they come up. So the focus of today's discussion you know, the violence that recently, you know, shook our country. It was unprecedented in our new democracy, and it really shook the foundations of our democracy and also the rule of law. And understandably, you know, we were in a position where the rule of law was already stretched almost to breaking point. And so this recent unrest has certainly added to that and severely shaken it even more. But you will hear from colleagues on this platform, led by Advocate de Kock, about the plans and the impact that this has had in terms of the caseloads. So we have, at a very high level, just as a matter of introduction, post those events, I had meetings with the National Commissioner of the Police, just in terms of organizing the response of criminal justice system, and in particular the police and the prosecution as the key departments. I also had meeting personally with General Labia as the head of the Hawks, the DPCI, in terms of organizing ourselves, because as you will hear from my colleagues, from Advocate de Kock, there were clearly several levels of perpetrators during this. And we have the lowest level, which is those that, you know, the let's call it the small low level looters, opportunistic. And then you have a level above that is the more organized looters, let's put it that way, those that came with vehicles and looted on a much more grand and organized scale. And then you have the inciters and those that incited on social media and other platforms. And then you have those that planned and organized this. And so we've had meetings with, you will hear from our colleagues, to deal with the different, each category there's a differentiated approach in respect of how we deal with each of those categories. But what is clear, though, is that, you know, it's become so cliched, but to deal with this kind of attack on our democracy, particularly getting to those most responsible, requires a very dedicated, focused approach. And so the importance of getting a task team together with the DPCI of committed, dedicated, skilled, and importantly, trusted staff members was hugely important to make sure, and trusted in the sense of people that you know will work objectively, follow the evidence, and make sure that at the end of the day, we act on where the evidence takes us. And so, you know, we hope that that the plans we've put in place will show results, and that there will be prosecutions that will help restore confidence in the rule of law, in the criminal justice system, and in the NPA. And so, Chair, with those words of introduction, if I may hand over to Advocate de Kock, who will continue with the presentation. I'm not sure if the presentation is flighted. We did send the presentation to the committee, but colleagues, I think someone will be flighting the presentation. Advocate de Kock, can I hand over to you?
Thank you very much, NDPP. Good afternoon, Chairperson of the Select Committee, and members, honourable members of the Select Committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to respond to the questions that have been posed to the MPA regarding its operations and the manner in which it has approached the recent unrest matters that have impacted upon the country and have impacted upon law enforcement generally. I think the NDPP has given the introduction, but just to emphasize that the upfront, that the MPA has worked critically with other law enforcement agencies, particularly the South African Police Service and the DPCI, in regard to the investigations and prosecutions of these cases. So from a coordination point of view at high level, the MPA nationally and at the provinces, the particularly affected provinces are KZN and Gauteng. The prosecution is working very closely on an ongoing basis with those relevant law enforcement agencies. So if we can move to the next slide, please. So we have submitted the presentation to the committee, and I assume that the committee members have all received a copy of the presentation. I will highlight certain aspects of the presentation. As far as the content of the presentation is concerned, we will present an overview of cases and the operations in relation to the unrest matters. We will deal with the coordination and cooperation with the SAPS and other relevant structures. We'll talk a bit about the action plan moving forward for prosecutions and convictions. I need to emphasize, Chairperson, that we would refrain from discussing in too much detail exactly the methodologies that are being followed. We understand that we are accountable to Parliament to report on the work that we do, but at the same time, we need to balance that against keeping the information and the nature of our activities, particularly when we are investigating crimes, from being disclosed in too much detail. And that's for obvious reasons, because we would not want to alert the perpetrators of crime to the manner in which we operate, in particularly during the investigative phase. So I say that up front, because you will see that as far as coordination and action plan is concerned, we give very high level account for the manner in which we are working. We will then speak also about the challenges and the lessons learned, as well as the impact of COVID-19 on the MPA and update on the vaccination process of MPA staff. So the unrest-related incidents initially emerged between the 7th to the 11th of July 2021. There were 170 new cases involving 190 accused enrolled at court. The week to the 12th, of the 12th to the 16th of July 2021 was a critical week in terms of the work that was being done and also the further crisis that evolved during that period. There were 680 new cases involving 1,249 accused enrolled at court, and this was an improvement from from the 19th of July 2021. 69 new cases involving 110 accused were enrolled at court, and currently there's an ongoing trickle of arrests in relation to investigations regarding the looting in particular. As I've indicated in the introduction, the biggest impact was in KZN and Gauteng, and initially transport-related issues impacted upon access to courts in KZN. The COVID-related reasons also played a role in relation to the functioning of the courts during those periods, because that was at the stage where the country was going through the peak of the third wave. Unrest in most other divisions were prevented due to community sectoral intervention and law enforcement's presence in those areas, and volumes impacted SAPS' ability to obtain information for consideration of bail. The overcrowding of SAPS cells had to be addressed, and we had to ensure that there was a quick processing, particularly when you have dealing with large numbers of arrests. So prosecutors had to be well organized in those courts. We want to say at this stage, if we can just move back, Initially, during the first week, there were particular challenges in the KZN courts because of access to the courts, disruptions to the infrastructure that existed in the province, particularly around fuel supply to garages, and the ability of prosecutors to be able to get to work. We initially, during that period, as the executive of the MPA, convened a meeting with the director of public prosecutions in the division, Advocate Zungu, where we discussed the challenges that were presented to her at the time, and where we then also, from a national point of view, supported the DPP in the area to ensure that we could process and deal with the matters as they came to the courts. So there was a critical relationship between the national executive, the NDPP, myself of the MPA, as well as our support staff, the special directors assigned to organized crime, priority crimes litigation, and the director of public prosecutions in the province, in particular, Advocate Zungu, and the head of the organized crime component in the DPP office. If we can move to the next slide. So as far as our operational action plan is considered, of course, the injunctions of the Constitution and the law is paramount in everything that we do as prosecution. And so it's important to understand that when prosecutors have to make decisions in regard to any matter, including these unrest cases, that it is done on the basis of evidence that is placed before us by the investigating authorities. Of course, we work very closely with the investigating authorities, as I've explained, to try and assist in preparation of that particular investigation and case docket, and to ensure that the evidence that is collected is admissible and credible for the purposes of taking a case to court. So this is an ongoing process. And as we speak, that process continues in all the courts, in all the cases that are affected by this particular intervention. So each case that comes to court is considered according to the normal principles and guidelines. We follow the principle of no case, no enrollment. So we try our best to screen matters. Sometimes it is difficult, if there are volumes of cases, to do that immediately. But that is the approach that prosecutors need to follow. But I again just remind the committee, and that is why I've indicated that there were serious disruptions, particularly in the initial phase, in the first week of the unrest, to our ability to process cases efficiently and effectively through the courts. We opposed bail in the serious matters that were presented to us. And in other matters, every endeavor was made to release perpetrators at the first available opportunity, so that we don't have a knock-on effect in terms of overcrowding at our correctional facilities. What the committee also needs to bear in mind, that this was at the heightened state of the COVID pandemic. And so there was clearly also an imperative on the prosecution to ensure that people are not held in conditions that will actually facilitate the spread of the virus. And the committee will appreciate that, particularly in court cells, they are not conducive to large volumes of people being held in cells. And so for those reasons, we needed to ensure that there was a quick and efficient movement of people through the court system. Security was an important aspect that we had to also consider. And so there were security management meetings held 3 times a day with stakeholder departments, under the leadership of the NAT joints and the provincial joints in the affected provinces, in particular KZN. If we can move to the next slide, please. So as far as the types of matters and the categories that we dealt with, and this was refined with time. Initially, we had four categories, but levels one and two were subsequently condensed into one level where we called it primary crimes and secondary crimes. So the first part of level one, primary crimes, were the actual looters and persons participating in stealing from shops and outlets. And now the secondary crimes, which we deal with, are persons found in possession of stolen property. And as I've indicated, these matters are still being investigated and people are still being arrested. So when you see there are arrests that are still current, it's then in relation to ongoing investigations where people are found in circumstances that may be suspicious or in possession of property that can be clearly identified as property that was stolen. And these cases, these people would then also be arrested, the property seized, and those cases will then be brought to court. So in collaboration and discussion with the role players and taking into account the pressures that we had on the system, as I explained, in terms of movement of people, and particularly trying to prevent further spread of COVID and further overcrowding in our correctional facilities, we did say up front, particularly to the Portfolio Committee on Justice, that the injustifiable cases, the MPA will consider alternative ways in dealing with those prosecutions, particularly restorative justice, admission of guilt fines, diversion, plea and sentence agreements, and of course mediation is also, informal mediation is also a process that's open to the MPA or to prosecutors. I may just add that each case is dealt with on a case-by-case basis, on an evaluation of the merits of the matter, and after taking careful consideration of the nature of the crime, the circumstances under which the crime was committed, and the accused and the profile of the accused as well. And then, of course, we should bear in mind that all of these accused were assisted, or all accused who enter into our court system once a case is enrolled, is entitled to legal representation, and legal aid is ensconced within the court system. And so each and every accused that we bring before the courts are entitled to representation. So the prosecutors would engage with lawyers, not the accused directly. And of course, the lawyers would advance the rights of the accused persons that they're acting for. So as far as the level two matters are concerned, these are groups and individuals stealing property in big quantities, organized or in a planned fashion. And clearly these cases are then of a more serious nature. And there are ongoing investigations in this particular area as far as these matters are concerned. Level three, initiating the unrest, enticement, inciting public violence. And here, the methodology and the approach that we followed was to ensure that prosecutors, very senior prosecutors, who generally appear in the high courts and who are based in each director of public prosecution's office, were seized with these matters, and they are currently still seized with these matters. Where they decide to prosecute, it will be these senior prosecutors who will conduct these trials. And of course, we accused plead not guilty. In the future, a full-blown trial will have to be held where evidence is led. So experienced prosecutors from our organized crime components will be leading those prosecutions. And of course, our priority crimes litigation unit plays a very critical role in support of these types of prosecutions where the more serious offenses in terms of the mandate of the PCLU is looked at. The PCLU's mandate relates to terrorism and it relates to treason and those offenses where the national director's authority is required to prosecute. So again, a collaboration between the National Office of the Prosecution and the Regional Office of the Prosecution under the leadership of the DPP. So currently in the KZN province, there are four high-profile cases involving incitement under investigation in KZN by the organized crime component. And we say there are five in Gauteng, and there's one in the Western Cape. We would not want to discuss too much detail regarding these matters, but we indicate to the committee that those are the matters that were presented to us by our operational component. Of course, this is an ongoing process. So by the time the presentation was prepared and submitted to the committee, that was the position. The investigations, as I've indicated, are ongoing with instigators and the planners of the unrest. Move to the next page. So I've already explained the teams and how they are structured as far as the prosecution are concerned. Then as far as our relationship with the police are concerned, the organized crime OC is organized crime PCLU, is priority crimes litigation unit. Head office attends a STEERCOM, that's a national meeting, chaired by the head of the DPCI every day. So shortly after these unrest matters started to occur, at the national level, we organized ourselves in such a way that we provided support to the Directorate of Priority Crimes Investigations. And because of the serious nature of these matters and the serious way in which law enforcement approached it, the head of the DPCI, General Abeya, chairs those meetings himself. The committee will appreciate that during the different phases of investigation and prosecution, the first phase relates to investigation. And during that phase, it is the mandate of the investigative agency to lead the process of investigation. So the prosecution is not leading the investigation. The prosecution is supporting the investigation, and the prosecution is assisting to ensure that the investigation is directed in a particular way that will add value ultimately to the decision-making process that prosecutors need to engage on later on to decide whether or not to prosecute. So I just emphasize that because it's not the mandate of the prosecution to actually investigate. But of course, we don't sit back and just say to investigators, continue. We work very closely with the investigators, and I think that's the point that we made by organizing ourselves as a steering committee where we discussed these cases. The NDPP was directly involved as well, and we also had a meeting between myself, the NDPP, and the head of the DPCI to indicate exactly how our formations have been organized. So high-level cases are discussed at this meeting together with the strategies that we need to adopt. And then we also attend the JOCOM meeting every day. That's a joint operations meeting that was managing broadly the response of law enforcement to the ongoing challenges. Now, these meetings are no longer happening every day because the unrest has subsided, but they still continue to meet at least three times a week to ensure that our forces are correctly deployed and that the coordination and communication happens effectively. So the role of the prosecution in all of these meetings is to ensure that when operations are executed and people are arrested, that the prosecutors are not caught by surprise and that we are able to process these matters efficiently through our court system. It's not to be involved in the operational decision-making of the police, of law enforcement, or of the defense force. That is not the prosecutor's job. The prosecutor's job is to ensure that we remain objective, and our role here is simply to ensure that we are aware of what is happening and that we can effectively communicate and coordinate our activities. As far as challenges are concerned, there is a challenge that we identified in terms of the ability of the investigating authorities to deal with the cyber forensic capabilities. We have received various assurances from the head of the DPCI that this matter is being attended to and that he's putting processes in place to strengthen the cyber forensic capabilities of the state. There's continuous engagement between the NPA and the DPCI on this important matter, so that we are able to preserve evidence from it to enable us to analyze that evidence properly and to convert that evidence for the purposes of trial. If we can move to the next slide. So, Chairperson and members of the committee, currently there are two murder cases that have been enrolled in the Pietermaritzburg High Court, and there's a further one under investigation. In the Mamelodi Court, matters on public violence will be transferred to the Pretoria Regional Courts in order to deal with the increased volumes. In Verulam, the only court where the priority court requires is currently and arranged, and it's arranged. So in Verulam, there is a priority court that has been established, and this is in line with the directive of the Minister of Justice, that where there's a need, we can establish a priority court to deal with these matters. So the Verulam court is one of example of such a site. Most cases have reported a decline in general cases enrolled in relation to public violence, and Section 36 of the General Law Amendment Act 62 of 1955, that's possession of suspected stolen property. So there's a general decline as we speak in relation to these matters, but as I've indicated previously, the investigations in relation to this particular work continues. If we may move. Chairperson, this is just a slide that tries to indicate to the committee currently what the state of the roles are in terms of public violence cases. So according to our administration system of the courts, there are 178 open public violence cases on the rolls with 990 accused persons. And let me just give a breakdown of the district and then of the regional courts. The chairperson and the members of the committee will recall that cases are first enrolled in our district courts. And then after the investigations have been completed and after preliminary issues have been dealt with, is a case transferred to a regional court for trial purposes. And this is done in consultation broadly with the regional court presidents of those courts. So that is why you will see the greater volume of the matters are in the district court and then those matters in our regional courts. If we can move to the next slide. These are the matters of public violence in relation to the unrest. And as you can see, there are 60 such matters currently on the court rolls, with 206 accused persons. Of course, as investigations continue, more people may be added to these charges. The next slide, please. This slide tries to capture the impact on correctional services. I did say to the committee in the introduction that part of our approach was to ensure that we don't exacerbate the challenges we have with overcrowding in the correctional centers. And also as a second aspect to prevent the spread of COVID into our correctional facilities. And so we will see that there's actually a decrease in the percentage of persons that are held in correctional facilities. So the simple point we make is that despite the unrest, we don't see an increasing number of people in our correctional facilities, but we actually see a decrease. And of course, that is also as part of our ongoing interventions through our senior public prosecutors at our courts to ensure that particularly awaiting trial detainees are released either on bail or on warning, so that we keep only people who demand to be in custody, whether they are a threat to the state, whether they are a threat to persons, whether they create a threat of further committing further offences that those are the persons who you'd like to keep in custody, or where they are a threat to community safety. So this picture actually tells us that we are doing well in terms of keeping the numbers of persons in our facilities under control, and the numbers have decreased, as you can see. We can move. This is just a snapshot in terms of how the matters have been dealt with. There are some finalized matters. There have been withdrawals. And this is an ongoing process. The majority of these cases must still be finalized. They're still on our court rolls. And this slide just gives us a snapshot of what the position is. If we may move to the next slide. So what are some of the issues that the MPA had to deal with initially? Dockets were brought to court. We picked up that the investigations were not as we would have expected. We returned many of the dockets to the police for further investigations. We've spoken about the daily meetings between the SAPS MPA and the Department of Justice at district, provincial and national level. The collaboration of information and data between our stakeholders. I've spoken about the communication, trying to ensure that there's effective communication between us. And then the directive by the Minister of Justice requires prioritization of certain categories of cases coordinated by the judiciary. Ultimately, the judiciary is in charge of the case management processes of the courts. But of course, the minister can issue directives in terms of generally how to approach the cases that flow through our court rolls. If we may move to the next slide. Advocate, get to the next slide, please.
It has moved, Advocate de Kock. I'm not sure if you are not seeing it.
Oh gosh, mine for some reason has stuck.
We're now on the
I'm turning to my hard copy. So just a minute, please, Jefferson.
It's headed impact on the NPA, and it deals with mainly the AFU and additional resources. I don't see a slide number to help you with that.
Okay, impact on the NPA. I found that, thank you. Additional resources and courts are not required at the moment. I think that we can safely say that the situation has been brought under control, and the operational management of all these matters on our court rolls are also under control. And so the cases are now brought within the normal operations of the courts, with one exception, that all these matters will receive priority attention. And so to the extent that these cases are ready to proceed for trial, we would like to ensure that the cases are prioritized so that we can get these matters finalized as speedily as possible. The AFU process, recovery process, will be aligned with the operational categories identified as set out above. And the AFU coordinated such recoveries in consultation with DPPs and the SAPs. The AFU recoveries are not only aimed at stolen property, but also property used in commission of crimes. And there's an existing collaboration of structures and nodal points attributed to overcome challenges. So I think the point that we make is that the asset forfeiture unit is directly involved in all of these matters and all of these investigations. And the AFU has a specific role to deal with recoveries and to deal with confiscation of assets. So I think my next impact on MPA AFU, have we dealt with that slide? Are we now on concluding remarks?
We are on 17, yes. Concluding
remarks. So concluding remarks, the prisoners awaiting trial detainees were at times not brought to court due to cluster COVID positive outbreaks in detention facilities. We did emphasize that the audiovisual links where they exist between the correctional centers and the courts that are utilized, and that's also part of the directive of the minister to ensure that cases can be postponed through an audiovisual link, and that we can deal with matters by using the audiovisual links that exist between corrections and the courts. During the unrest, looting and outbreaks in the divisions, the SAPS detention facilities were overcrowded, and access to food for detainees became a challenge. I must add that this was just during the initial phase, the first week and a half, but that was quickly managed and brought under control by the South African Police Service and through the coordination of the joints and the NAT joints at a national level. Due to the unrest, vigilante groupings sprouted and crime scenes quickly shifted, resulted in challenges with regard to identification of criminal elements. Of course, there was quite a bit of chaos initially in terms of what was happening on the ground, but now all those matters are being investigated, particularly where vigilantes took law into their own hands. And as I've indicated, there are two such matters already enrolled on the court roll in the KZN courts, in the KZN High Court. The seizure of abandoned looted goods resulted in no cases being opened at and offenders could be linked. The mass seizures in certain areas led to no arrests. The SAPS have released accused persons for future dates via SAPS 496 and J398, as well as J534. Hence, the actual number of unrest cases in court remains unquantifiable. So the police sometimes would release suspects on bail or release suspects on a summons to appear in court. And of course, though, those cases are still being processed into the future under our court rolls. So these numbers will be adjusted as we move forward and as the systems are updated. The arrest statements did not properly deal with all the elements of crimes, especially Section 36 of the General Law Amendment Act. So I've indicated that initially there were challenges with the manner in which these investigations were being done. And we quickly organized ourselves nationally at the national office to ensure that we put in place some training with the police. And we also share training material with the police on the ground to ensure that matters are properly investigated and evidence is properly collected. So that was also done. You can move to the next slide, please. The coordination structures, Chairperson, I have referenced quite a bit of this already, but in a snapshot, that is the national and the provincial coordination through the Joint Operational Committee, the JOCOM, and the national case coordination meetings between the SAPS, the DPCI, the FPA, the DOJ, and the Correctional Department. We referenced also the NAC joints for national coordination and the provincial coordination through our provincial joints. And then there's direct contact between the branch commanders, the station commanders of SAPS, and the senior public prosecutors. And that is in relation to individual dockets. We indicate that all partners monitor and discuss progress, challenges, and resolutions daily at the district, provincial, and national level. And of course, these daily meetings are not as intensive at the moment because, like I've indicated, the unrest has been brought under control. We spoke about the training. We spoke about the high-profile matters, the levels 2 and 3, dealt with by the organized crime components of the MPA and the DPCI. The SAPS's national instruction issued for public violence investigations to be prioritized and law enforcement officials attend court on trial dates. That is a further indication of the seriousness within which we are taking the matters, and from a SAPS point of view, a specific instruction has been given in relation to those matters. High profile unrest dockets to be taken immediately to chief prosecutors, senior public prosecutors, on the registration of the dockets. so that we can assist to guide those investigations. So going forward, Chairperson and members of the committee, we have established task teams to deal with specific matters. We speak about the matters that arose in the Phoenix area, and as well as the incitement matters, where there are task teams assigned to deal with those matters. We speak about the SAP's dedicated national task team, which will follow up on withdrawals and struck for all matters during the next 2 weeks. This is 2 weeks from the preparation of this presentation to Parliament. This is again just to make sure that we understand why those cases were withdrawn or why they were struck off the roll, so that that could be corrected when necessary. Progress is still, they are still monitoring in collaboration with stakeholders at all levels. At court, the Provincial Court Optimization Committee, which is chaired by the Regional Head Department of Justice, is meeting to discuss the operational challenges at court, and this includes the impact of COVID-19 on performance of the courts, as well as those unrest cases as priority cases. If we may move on. So if we come to the aspects regarding challenges and lessons learned, the first point is the importance of using technology during the investigations. Secondly, the lack of resources, both in equipment and staff required for technology, as well as infrastructure and the maintenance of electronic equipment. Changes to legislation required to allow acceptance of evidence and the usage of technology. The need to increase engagement and coordination between the SAPS, the DOJ, and the MPA at district levels to deal with operational challenges. And provincial senior management of stakeholders need to be proactive and meet immediately when unplanned actions like these arise. So some of these lessons arose because of the state of readiness at the time. We understand and we know that the narrative has been that the country as a whole was not ready for such a massive response in terms of unrest. And this impacted across the board. But after the first week, law enforcement in particular and our courts did everything in our power to reorganize ourselves and to ensure that we are able to deal with the challenges. If we can move on. So as far as the COVID-19 impact on the MPA is concerned, the chairperson, we can see this graph indicates what the situation is in our different provinces. Just to say that the NPA is monitoring the situation on a daily basis in relation to all our offices throughout the country, and reports are prepared by our colleagues at the national level and then indicated to the NDPP, to the executive of the organization, and to all the regions what the situation is on a daily basis. It also references what the situation is generally in the country. We initiated additional special exco meetings to also look at how we must support prosecutors, and particularly the divisions, and what it is that the MPA needs to do to ensure that all our staff are protected. So during July and August, despite all the challenges, we did not find it necessary to close any court in KZN. If we can move on. So just to make the points that when an MPA official or any other court official is affected by COVID-19, there needs to be isolation. People must be quarantined. There's decontamination of offices that must happen. And this impacts, of course, on the ability of those offices to function effectively. So it impacts on prosecutors, on court staff, police officials, correctional services, attorneys, accused, and witnesses. The rotation of staff amongst role play is important, but sometimes becomes complicated. So because of the level four situation in the country, we introduced rotation of staff amongst the prosecutors. This, of course, becomes more difficult in our district courts because we require prosecutors to be on duty in courts to ensure that the courts are functioning. But the approach that the MPA Exco followed was to provide the authority to make those decisions to the regional managers and the local managers on a day-to-day basis in terms of planning, understanding what is impacting on their ability to function, and to ensure that the safety of the staff is paramount. So from our point of view as the MPA senior leadership, the safety of our staff was paramount, and we had to do everything in our power to ensure that we limit the number of infections. As can be seen from the slide that we showed, the graph, during the level four period, there was a steep increase in the number of prosecutors that were affected. Of course, many of these matters are completely out of our control, because it's not necessarily that prosecutors are infected at courts or that court officials are affected at courts. Often the position is that people are affected outside of the courts, but they bring the virus into the court system. So prioritization remains important. The new DCS regulations on accused who cannot afford bail to be reconsidered within 7 days, long awaiting remand detainees, is an ongoing issue that prosecutors must reassess. Of course, the public in unrest cases are taken into account, backlog cases, sexual offences cases, gender-based violence, corruption, children and vulnerable persons. These are all the cases that we've identified as priority cases. And these are the cases that gets priority attention on our court rolls. If I can move on. So this is just trying to give some kind of example of how, if one prosecutor is affected, how potentially it can actually impact broader than just taking one person out of the court system. And this slide then gives an indication of the greater impact in relation to such a scenario. So one prosecutor can be in contact with six other prosecutors and two senior public prosecutors, and that can affect four courts when you have to remove those people from courts because of isolation or quarantine. So it is a very difficult scenario that we have been confronted with, but we do our best to try and manage our operations on an ongoing basis. You can move to the next slide. So the MPA leadership decided that in response to the ever-increasing numbers of prosecutors that were being affected, and in fact, some prosecutors actually succumbed to this virus, unfortunately, we decided it was important that all prosecutors need to get vaccinated as soon as possible because they are frontline staff. So the vaccinations in relation to prosecutors started on the 29th of July 2021. After vaccination sites were communicated by the Department of Health, sites were circulated to all staff for vaccination purposes. Including was a list of vaccine coordinators for each division, so that from a communication point of view, where a prosecutor wasn't sure what to do, we had coordinators in each division to assist. Some staff have already received vaccinations before the 29th of July. We will recall that the older and more senior prosecutors would have benefited from their age, which generally is a disadvantage. In this case, it was an advantage. And then the encouragement of staff to vaccinate is ongoing. Just recently, at a coordination meeting of the directors of public prosecutions, I emphasized that it's the responsibility of management to understand within each prosecution office which prosecutors have been vaccinated, because we do know that sometimes either people are reluctant or they're not sure of the process, and so they don't get themselves vaccinated. So we emphasize that managers must make sure that the staff, one, are understanding what they need to do to get vaccinated, two, where they are reluctant to be vaccinated, to assist them and to encourage them to get the vaccination and try to keep some record. So we say that approximately 47% of the staff of the prosecution have currently been vaccinated, so it's almost 50%. And this is an ongoing effort for us to get all our staff vaccinated. If we can move to the next slide. I think that is the presentation in the PP from our side. I hand back to you. If there's anything further that you would like to add. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Advocate de Kock. Thank you, Honorable Chair. That is the presentation of the NPA, and we stand ready to answer questions and discussion. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for outlining the work done by the NPA during the unrest, despite the challenges that were posed by the unrest as well as the COVID-19 pandemic. Honourable members, that is quite a lengthy presentation, so I'm going to go straight into questions of clarity and of comments that you would want to make as honourable members. If you can maybe perhaps give me an indication by raising your hand. Okay, I'm noting Honourable Bartlett for now. Perhaps other honourable, again, Honourable Nkosi to follow. We'll take it as it comes. Honourable Bartlett, you on the floor? Honourable Bartlett?
Sorry, Chair. Sorry for this.
No problem. Honourable Dodowo, you noted? Honourable Bartlett?
Yes. Sorry, Chair. Chair, I have three questions. The first one is the lack of cyber investigative capabilities. What steps have been undertaken to resolve the challenge and the time frames for the resolution of this matter? It will be very important for us as a committee. And the second one, Chair, regards to the lack of resources. Can you please elaborate on the extent of the resources required to the NPA to conduct its work efficiently and effectively, and how that will be addressed moving forward, and what measures will be taking place? And on the third one, Honorable Chairperson, on slide 23, they mentioned the prioritization of cases, particularly gender-based violence and femicide. What measures are being put in place to ensure that these cases receive the necessary attention? I thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Bartlett. Honorable Nkosi?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good afternoon to your good self and the members and everybody present in the meeting. Chair, let us start by welcoming the presentation made by the APID and NPA. Chair, my questions, one, I just want to, I think I've got three questions related to NPA. The first question is appearing on slide 6. States that large numbers of accused initially brought to court with statements incomplete, and that the NPA provided training notes to SAPS. Were these notes sufficient or is further comprehensive training required with SAPS? What other challenges remain between SAPS and the NPA, which may require additional training? The other question is regarding with slide 7. Mentions justifiable cases which may result in restorative justice measures being implemented. Can they please provide more clarity to the committee on the nature of these cases and the current number of these cases resulting in restorative measures being implemented? Have any children been affected by the unrest? What other alternative measures are being implemented within the criminal justice system in relation to children? The last question on NPA is...
recording stopped.
With regards to slide 14. Slide 14 reflects a high number of cases being struck off the roll for the inability to give account of possession of goods suspected of being stolen.
Recording in progress.
With more details on this. On the iPad, Chair, I've got three questions also. Let me stop there for now. Okay.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Let me also take the opportunity to meet the Director of the National Prosecuting Authority and her team, and equally welcome the presentation that was made this afternoon to us. I really want to applaud the NPA for the work done. All that I will say is that their work is cut out. It's a lot of work. It requires resilience. It requires commitment. And it requires utmost dedication to ensure that we deal with the challenges that we are facing as a country. And just listening to presentation and what I witnessed myself, what the NPA is doing is quite good in terms of prosecuting the perpetrators of these heinous crimes which were perpetuated both in KwaZulu-Natal as well as Gauteng. I think this is quite good. But my view, Honorable Chairperson, is that we must not go for the ordinary people who looted per se. We must go and investigate the orchestrators, the planners, the schemers of these heinous crimes which happened. I think the country has averted a major crisis, a crisis of massive proportions, and I really want to applaud the NPA for the work that it executed. I have a view that going forward, they must ensure that they prepare thoroughly for those who were implicated, those who were charged, those who were prosecuted, and must deal with them quite decisively. But further than that, they must investigate, because this, in my honest view, was quite big, and the disastrous consequences thereof were going to leave our country into a very, very perilous state. And that we applaud. But as I'm saying, we need to go deeper into this to ensure that we deal with everything that was perpetuated, including all of its manifestations. Every time when I listen to the Director of Public Prosecution, I get inspired. I feel that here, indeed, the country has got a woman who is committed to doing her job. I still have an appointment with the director to finalize the matters of the Northwest, where I come from, in respect of Section 8 interventions. Yes, we also, in that respect, want to see the result. But what I see here and the presentation itself, as I indicated, it inspires confidence, and I'm very, very much happy about the work of the NPA in this particular instance. I don't have a question. All that I'm saying is a word of commendation and a word of encouragement that they must keep up the good work. It is not going unnoticed. We see what they are doing in terms of it and executing our country. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Zedobu. for those comments. Okay. Just from my side, I actually just have two questions, National Director. The one relates to the integrated task team on the management of unrest-related cases convened by the Department of Justice. Just in terms of how effective has this task team been to address blockages across the criminal justice value chain? How effective has it been to date? And what are the current challenges and the lessons learned in respect of this task team? Just a moment. Mfunzo, are you able to mute yourself, please?
Sorry, sir.
No problem. As I was saying, my second question relates to what are the key lessons and proposals made from the NPA in respect of the unrest, but also in respect of strengthening the JCPS cluster moving forward. In practical terms, what needs to be put in place to mitigate against some of these challenges moving forward? With that, National Director, I hand over to you to maybe respond to those issues raised by members.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I will take a number of the questions, including the last ones relating to the JCPS and the resourcing issue. But I'll first hand over to Advocate de Kock to deal with some of the issues that were raised in respect of the restorative justice and issues with training children affected. Chair, but perhaps before Advocate de Kock, I should maybe say make some high level comments on the resourcing issues. It's good that colleagues, members of the committee have raised this issue, because in as much as we have in the justice cluster, well, speaking particularly about the NPA and to a certain extent the SAPS, in particular the Hawks, the DPCI, have received some additional budget to deal with these issues. From the perspective of the NPA moving forward, and perhaps it would be good for the committee to understand this, that if you look at the increase that the NPA has received, and we didn't intend to do a budget presentation, so I don't have the figures before me, but if one factors in the cost of living and inflation, NPA will receive about a 2% increase. And there are serious challenges with regard to our compensation budget. It's a very small percentage. I think it's about 11% of our budget goes to goods and services, which is under severe strain. And you've got to understand, no doubt you do, that when you're able to capacitate, because we are able to bring in, we've been on a massive recruitment, strategy recruitment process, but you've got to be able to give people the tools and the necessary training and other support that goes with them to ensure that they're well equipped to deal with it. And that's where the goods and services comes in. So there are still, although we are capacitating, there are still serious skills shortages, both in the NPA to deal with highly complex corruption matters. I know that the DPCI is seriously constrained as well. General Labia has been trying to capacitate also in terms of recruiting, but that's not where it ends. You know, you need your high-end skills to deal with even cases like this, where you're looking at putting cases together. You need your cyber analytical investigative analytical capabilities. And General Labia has indicated that they are thin on this and that he is trying to deal with it. I think he'll be best placed to address what he's doing in that space. But even in the NPA, there have been training sessions, and we are looking at capacitating prosecutors to deal with these issues. So the resource issue still remains a huge challenge. Within the NPA, we've also done a new HR plan now, We have also, we are doing a skills audit. We are looking at identifying specific skills that are scarce in the NPA. We've just developed our scarce skills framework within the NPA so that we're able to attract people with those scarce skills at a slightly better remuneration package. So these are the things that we've been trying to do, but there are still major resourcing. I think we cannot underestimate the challenges in law enforcement, and in particular in the investigation in SAFs with regard to dealing with these matters. There is a project within the JCPS to deal with setting up forensic capability within government, because government spends an astronomical amount of money getting these services, forensic capable, forensic services, particularly for your high-end cases. The Hawks outsources a lot of this. And so there is a process at the moment within the JCPS, and I'll talk a little bit more at the end about that, about the JCPS more broadly, but to deal with this, to set up a government forensic capability so that we don't have to outsource these issues, particularly in the space of the DPCI. I'll come back later, but I'll call on Advocate de Kock to deal with some of the questions, and those that he doesn't deal with, I'll come back to in the end, particularly the JCPS issues. Advocate de Kock?
Thank you very much. I'm not sure, Chairperson, if I'm visible, because I'm still seeing the NDPP on the screen.
You are visible. Thank you. Sorry, Chair.
Perhaps you can just switch yours off NDPP then. Thank you. So just to emphasize, Chairperson, that the more serious investigations in relation to the unrest matters are dealt with by the organized crime components of the NPA, which are located in the Directors of Public Prosecutions offices and the director and the DPCI. So from our point of view, those categories of matters, we have sufficient resources to give it appropriate attention. Also in collaboration with our national organized crime component and our priority crimes litigation unit. The bulk of the matters, however, are dealt with on our general court rolls, particularly in our district courts. And as I've indicated, these matters are still being prosecuted or processed through our courts. Those are then prosecutors who are located at our district courts and at our regional courts. So the cases, all of them are receiving the necessary attention. But as we speak, as the NDPP has indicated, the broader question around resourcing of the NPA remains an absolute priority for the organization going forward. So, Honorable Chairperson and members of the committee, I would like to introduce to the committee the head of the organized crime component of the NPA, Advocate Andrea Johnson. She is a Deputy Director of Public Prosecutions in the National Prosecuting Service, which is the unit that is overseen by myself. And so she reports to me. And she is also the colleague who works very closely in the National Steering Committee. So I'd just like her to address the one aspect relating to the cyber investigative capability and the training and the ongoing training that was done by the NPA with the colleagues of the police and the DPCI. So with your permission, NDPP and the Honorable Chair, if I could just ask Advocate Johnson to deal with those questions and any other aspect relating to national coordination and the provincial coordination and the role of the NPA, particularly in the provincial coordination. Advocate Johnson.
Good afternoon, Chair. Good afternoon, honorable members, the NDPP, Advocate de Kock and fellow colleagues in the NPA. If we could deal with the training, Honourable members, we assist the training needs the first week after we received cases. It became very apparent after the first week of cases being enrolled that the quality of investigations unfortunately left much to be desired. And that status quo could not be left as was. Advocates for organized crime and myself got together. We engaged with General Labia, the head of the DPCI. We engaged with Lieutenant General Sento Mule, who is the Divisional Commissioner, Detectives and Forensic Services. And over the weekend of the 24th and 25th of July, we put together an urgent training intervention, which took place virtually on Monday, the 26th of July. It was attended also by the head of the DPCI and the Divisional Commissioner Detectives. There were members from Crime Intelligence and then the compositions from the NPA. And perhaps the biggest shortcoming we had considered, Chair, was the fact that the cyber capabilities were seriously lacking and are still seriously lacking, unfortunately, within the police services. And to that end, General Labia has made undertakings. That being said, it does not mean that we cannot proceed with those investigations and prosecutions. And what prosecutors sought to do in the training intervention is to indicate, Chair, how you go about gathering evidence, what kind of evidence would be required, how we were to go about securing that evidence, and to ensure that the evidence was court directed. Bearing in mind, as we would all know, that when you look at what was going on in terms of the unrest, much of it happened on social media, and we were very mindful of the fact that there might be allegations that persons of interest, their social media posts would have been manipulated. To that end, we sought then to give that urgent training. And also where there were and still are legislative constraints, the Cyber Crimes Act, although it has been signed by the President, has not come into operation. We had to figure out how we would deal with the current intake of cases in terms of the old Electronic Communications and Transactions Act of 2012. We also then dealt with issues of sedition. We dealt with issues of incitement. And to say, Chair and Honourable Members, that the purpose behind that entire exercise was based solely on the fact that the country, having been caught as unawares as it was, did not mean that law enforcement and the prosecution should then be unaware of how to deal with things, the urgency of how we dealt with things, and that we needed to deal with them. And that was the purpose of the training. And the training also sought to guide investigators and to reassure them that prosecutors are available, remain available to guide investigations, to ensure the proper collection of evidence, chain of custody of evidence, and that when we do go to court, we not only have the right person, but we have factual, correct evidence so that we prefer the right charges. We have to be very mindful, Chair and Honourable Members, this is perhaps one of the most difficult matters our country will deal with, and therefore prosecutions and investigations must be done in a very coordinated manner. And that was the purpose of the training. With regards to the question of planners, I would just like to reassure you, Chair and Honourable Members, we are getting there. We do not want to rush into things. There are various levels and facets of the investigation. It doesn't just deal with planners. It would also have to look at financiers. It would have to look at the who's who that pushed the buttons, motivated and incited people. So we are mindful of the full picture, and we will most certainly be getting there. And prosecutors guide the investigations from the very get-go. We are not only looking, Chair, at police dockets. We are also looking at inquiry files to ensure that even if there's an inquiry, it is dealt with in a serious and coordinated manner, and that at the end, if that inquiry can be converted into a case docket and someone can be arrested and held accountable for their criminal actions, that will then in fact be done. And then lastly, Chair, we do work jointly with the DPCI, with the detectives and with crime intelligence, and the steering committee meeting every day from 4 to 5, chaired by the head of the DPCI, consists of that composition. And so on a daily basis, on that high level, we are looking at the inciters, instigators, and other levels of criminality. I thank you, Chair, and thank you, NDPP.
Thank you, Advocate Johnson. Advocate de Kock, there were some questions on restorative.
Yes.
Will you? Thank you. Go ahead.
Yes. So I will deal with the rest of the question of the questions before you come in, NDPP. There was the first question on gender-based violence and femicide matters, and what are we doing to ensure that these cases are prioritized? So within the six-month priority plan of the MPA, this is one of the initiatives that is getting particular attention, not just now, not just during the six-month period, but what we have done is to enhance the focus on gender-based violence and femicide cases because of the absolute priority for the country in terms of these matters. We know that within the MPA, we have a particular focus through our sexual offences and community affairs unit on these matters, with things like training, capacitation, and giving strategic and capability to these areas of work is dealt with at the national office. In our courts, we have these dedicated sexual offences courts, and we have the Tutuzela care centres that provide services and comfort to these victims. But in particular, what we've done in the last 2 to 3 months is to focus on femicide matters and to develop a protocol that is going to be applied uniformly throughout all our divisions of the prosecution in terms of how we deal with femicide cases, and in particular to identify all femicide cases within the country and within the court, on our court rolls. The objective, of course, is to ensure that these cases get the necessary attention, both from an investigation and from a prosecution point of view. So that is ongoing work, and that work is happening as we speak. The other important area that is linked to that is the aspect relating to the DNA labs of the South African Police Services for the outcomes of the results. Now, we are aware that there was a particular challenge with the ability of the labs to provide timeously the results of DNA analysis in relation to important cases like femicide and gender-based violence. Of course, also murder matters. So the prosecution at the national level have been working very closely with the police forensic labs to ensure that these cases are prioritized. And what we've done is to identify all the matters on our court rolls that requires the DNA analysis, and to work very closely with the labs to ensure that those analyses are received. So by all accounts, over the last 2 to 3 months, we've really improved the flow of the information from the labs to the courts. And we have further injunction given to directors of public prosecutors that any case on the court roll where there is a risk to that particular matter either being struck off a court roll or withdrawn because of the outstanding DNA analysis, that those cases are then escalated to our national office, and our national office then engages on a daily basis with the lab to ensure that those reports are prioritized so that we can get the reports to the respective court. So that is aspects of how we are ensuring that gender-based violence and femicide matters are receiving the necessary attention on our court rolls. As far as children are concerned, we were in conflict with the law during this unrest period. The provisions of the Child Justice Act would apply to those matters. And children would be diverted out of the system from the initial arrest in terms of the Child Justice Act. The question regarding restorative justice and the current numbers. This is an ongoing process. So as the cases are finalized, we will receive information from our various prosecution officers in terms of the finalization of all cases, either through trials, through guilty pleas, through fines payable or admission of jail fines in inappropriate matters, and of course through restorative justice and mediations. So we, as far as the numbers are concerned, this is an ongoing process, and as these cases are finalized, we will keep record of those numbers, and we will be happy to provide the committee with that information into the future. The cases struck off the court rolls and how we are dealing with that, as indicated in the presentation, we have at the national level communicated with the South African Police Services, and we have requested that all those dockets that were struck off the roll or withdrawn should be analyzed with a view to establish what the reasons were for that, so that we can correct. Should it be found that the case was withdrawn because there was insufficient evidence in regard to the elements of a particular offense that needed to be prosecuted, and where it can be cured with further investigation, that is the instruction, that the further investigation continues, and so that the prosecutors are in a position to review that particular matter, and where a decision is made to prosecute, those individuals will be brought back to court to face the consequences of the actions. So in the PP, I think I've covered most of the areas, but just to acknowledge, of course, the words of encouragement for the prosecutors on the ground. We recognize that the prosecutors on a daily basis are confronted with many challenges, including the COVID, and they are really people of integrity who do their best under very difficult circumstances. I think that's all from our side. Thank you, NDPP.
Advocate de Kock, before you go, I didn't catch the first part of the chair's question. I got the second part, which I'm happy to deal with. The first part talked about the integrated task team and to address blockages. So I to understand from the chair, I don't know if you noted the question fully, whether it was to address blockages in the courts, if you could, if I got that right.
Yes, so the integrated task team that is referred to in this instance would be at the provincial level, at the court level, to ensure that the initial blockages were in relation to how matters are being brought to court, the numbers of people that were arrested, the impact of the on the infrastructure that was happening at the time. In some instances, the prosecutors and other court officials could not get to the courts. And so at the, particularly in the KZN, that integrated structure led by senior officials of the prosecution and the Department of Justice was designed to ensure that we could get those cases managed effectively through the court system. Initially, as I've indicated, when we met with the Director of Public Prosecutions of KZN, she did raise a number of concerns about our ability to do the work. But the reports that we've received since then from the Director, and we did receive a very substantial report from her just about a week ago, that matters have improved substantially since then, and the operations of the courts are effective. And that matters have been normalized in our courts. So to answer the question, the integration and the coordination has been effective. They've dealt with the challenges that originally was identified or were identified at those particular courts, and that we have now the normal operations happening in those courts again. In the PP, I think, I'm not sure if there's anything further, but that's just broadly at a very high level. Particularly in relation to the unrest matters. Of course, Chairperson, there are other coordinating structures, both at the national and at the court level, but I'm not going to delve into those ones at the moment. But those ones are generally led by the judiciary. But I don't think it's part of the brief now in the PP for us to delve into those ones. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much, Advocate de Kock. Chair, the questions that you raised around the proposals in respect of strengthening the JCPS cluster as a whole. Chair, It's within the JCPS cluster at the moment. There's certainly been a recognition, and this was even before the unrest. There was already a recognition that the efficiency and effectiveness of the JCPS cluster as a whole left a lot to be desired. And this was a recognition amongst ourselves. And the reality is that, you know, the work of the cluster, we still have crime rates that are going up every day. You know, people, South Africans don't feel safe. And that is the high level objective of the JCPS. So this recognition led to the creation of a task team within the JCPS. It is, which is conducting a review of the work of the JCPS. The task team is chaired by myself and Advocate Kanyile from the Financial Intelligence Center. But focusing on the JCPS being able to achieve its mandate and the outcomes in terms of the MTSF, the way it's organized, its substructures, and whether what we can do to enhance efficiency. But Chair, that process doesn't talk to perhaps what you were responding to as a result of the recent unrest and the inability of the cluster departments to respond and the criticism that the JCPS cluster received as a result of that. Chair, I think there's, you know, we work together. We are very strong in terms of relationships in the JCPS. They're very good. I work very well with all the relevant heads of entities, etc. But there are serious institutional problems, Chair, that we really have to acknowledge and accept. And perhaps certain entities need complete reform in the JCPS. We are struggling against the weakening of the systems of the entities in the recent past. We are struggling with lack of skills. We are struggling with demotivation. We are struggling with corruption within the ranks of the entities themselves. And when you combine all of this, the lack of skills, it is a very, very difficult environment. And a lot is happening. We are doing a lot. But there needs to be wholesale reform in certain departments in order to really deal with some of these systemic, endemic problems, particularly relating to corruption. And Chair, you know, we in the NPA, certainly, I'm not saying the NPA has its own challenges also with regard to some of these issues, skills, corruption, but we've taken a zero tolerance approach to corruption. We are setting up an Office of Complaints and Ethics, and the prosecutors know on a daily basis that if you attempted, there will be a process, and that there's a very good chance that you will lose your job. And Chair, we're really trying to do what we can, but there are so many systemic problems within the criminal justice system that regrettably there's not a silver bullet. And it would take a really strong political will and government to really have some very serious interventions in terms of trying to strengthen the JCPS cluster, which has really shown to have some serious gaps and weaknesses in recent times. But, you know, there is a road ahead. We're working hard. I still have hope. And we thank our Honorable Dodovo for those words of encouragement, because we really need to stay the course and remain motivated. And we are. This is not the time to jump ship. It's really to stay the course. And in fact, the recent events shows us more how important the work that we do, in the NPA, in the justice system, and how important it is for us to really stay the course and do the best that we can to make sure that something like this doesn't ever happen in our country again. And if it does, that the response is much quicker and that we're able to avert the damage and destruction that happened. But I am confident, as you heard from Advocate Johnson, we're working hard with the SAPS to try to ensure that those that were behind this, those most responsible, are brought to book. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, the National Director of Public Prosecutions, Neba Toy. I think our own members, the NPA has largely covered a lot of the issues that we raised, and I think we should actually thank them for their presentation as well as their responses to questions and or comments that have been posed by members. I think it certainly provided us as a committee with the much needed insight into the manner in which the NPA is managing its caseload and the cooperation between the NPA and the South African Police Services. And we note that the Department of Justice has identified that need to increase engagement and coordination between staff, the Department of Justice, and the NPA district level to deal with operational challenges. Mabitoa, you know this would interest us a lot as the National Council of Provinces, given that we represent provinces and we engage also at that level. And we're also particularly interested in ensuring that this level of engagement continues and it is also effective in terms of ensuring successful prosecution. Well, we do wish you courage, Mabitoa, in terms of the work you do and the challenges that you encounter. And we'd like to continue encouraging the NPA to continue doing the good work that it does, but also to continue strengthening its working relationship with other departments within the JCPS cluster. And we also hope to have more engagements with the National Prosecuting Authority going forward. With those words said, I want to thank you once again very much, National Director, and your team for attending this meeting and engaging with us as a committee. Thank you very much. You're free to leave the platform. As I indicated, we're having a back-on-back meeting with the Independent Police Investigative Directorate. So I think I'm going to move on to the next.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chair. We appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Our members, we'll move on to the presentation from the Independent Police Investigative Directorate. I note that the Deputy Minister, you've joined us. Welcome. We had started this meeting and we initially engaged the National Prosecuting Authority. We're now moving on to the Independent Police Investigative Directorate. I think in terms of my introduction, Deputy Minister, we gave an indication that the National Council of Provinces is busy with its committee week where we do oversight in the field. However, the NCOP has identified the theme for this week being mitigating the impact of COVID-19 and the recent looting, violence and destruction. And this will be followed by a debate in the NCOP on the 26th of August, 2021. And as part of our oversight program, we undertook to meet with the South African Police Services, to meet with the National Prosecuting Authority and to meet with IPED. But in addition to that, we have also engaged the Department of Correctional Services in terms of the recent unrest that had happened at the at the Correctional Service in Umzinto, which we actually had that engagement this morning. But I think in terms of our meeting with the Independent Police Investigative Directorate, we want to meet with you to also understand the extent of the recent civil unrest on the department's caseload as well. We particularly concerned about the fact that 74 cases have been reported to IPED for investigation. 61 were in KwaZulu-Natal and 13 in Gauteng province. We'd like to understand the efforts that have been undertaken to mitigate also the impact of COVID-19 within the Independent Police Investigative Directorate, as well as its impact on the caseload in light of the unrest. And I think in terms of today's meeting, we would want to understand I'll be given an overview of the misconduct cases in relation to staff members and the Metro Police, the overview of cases under investigation currently, the cooperation and coordination in relation to cases being investigated, the challenges and the lessons learned, as well as the impact of COVID-19. So I think it's important that as a committee within the NCOP that we have this briefing with yourself. And I think I'm going to then hand over to you, Deputy Minister. I hope you're still with us.
I'm with you, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Maybe I'll hand over to yourself to do some opening remarks, and then request the Executive Director to then take us through the presentation. Deputy Minister?
No, thank you very much, Chair. It's very clear that you had a very long day. When I connected here, I found the meeting on, and the NPA and the NDPP were responding. I must confirm that indeed we are working together to deal with the challenges that they raised around cases that are currently on the court roll. We are working very closely with the Deputy Minister, John Jeffries. I don't want to be long, because I think it has been long, not only for yourself, also for ourselves. Greet you and greet the members of your committee, and appreciate the moment you have given us to come here and account to the provinces, since the NCOP is a platform wherein provincial views and aspirations get debated and advanced. And we think it's appropriate that as we are requested to come to appear before you, we must make time to do so. And we have done exactly that in this regard. I'm with the Executive Director and the team. If you may allow me, Chair, I will, without belaboring the point, request that the Executive Director introduce the delegation she's with and proceed with the presentation as requested by your good self. If you may allow, Chair, I will request that the Executive Director introduce her delegation and make the presentation. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Deputy Minister. Executive Director?
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister, and good afternoon, Chairperson, and the esteemed members of the Select Committee. Thank you for affording us this opportunity to come and do a presentation to you about the unrest that we experience. Let me indicate, Chairperson, that I am with my colleagues who are working on the unrest cases. With me is Mr. Matthew Sisoko, who is the National Head of Investigation. I'm also joined by the Head of IPIT in Gauteng, Ms. Azande Njangase, and I'm also joined by the Head of KZN IPIT, Ms. Charmaine van der Sand. So, Chairperson, we will flight our presentation. Mem Paho, can you flight the presentation?
Executive Director, who's writing the presentation?
Antoinette Mpaho. Antoinette, can you flash the presentation, please?
I see. Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson and ED. I've tried to share it, so you're not able to see the slide.
No, we are not seeing anything.
Is it okay?
Okay, Edi, let me try to share the presentation. Okay, we see.
Okay. We can see. Can you see it, Chairperson?
Yes, we can. Please continue.
Okay, thank you very much. Next slide, Mr. Mamabulu. This is the table of content. Can you go straight to the slides? Thank you. Let me just give our overview for this presentation. One, it's around the unrest related cases were reported in KZN as well as Gauteng province. IPIT received a total number of 74 cases related to the recent unrest. Of the 74 cases received, 61 were in KZN and 13 in Gauteng province. Majority of these cases reported were cases of death as a result of police action, with 26 cases reported, followed by assault with 25 cases, complaints of discharge of official firearms with 17 cases, 4 deaths in police custody. The least cases reported were torture with 2 cases. The information on the breakdown of cases per province and classification is reflected on the slides that are following. And according to the statistical data as illustrated on table 1 below, Phoenix is the one that Phoenix Police Station received a high intake of cases, with 9 cases reported, of which 6 are assault and 3 are death as a result of police action. Next slide. Let me hand over to Mr. Sisoko, who is the national head of investigation, to then take us through the rest of the slides. Over to you, Mr. Sisoko.
Thanks, Edi, and good day, Chairperson and honorable members of the committee. Good day, Deputy Minister and colleagues. This slide, Chairperson, talks to the cases that were reported relating to the recent unrest. You'll note from the table that is a total of 74 cases. We broke them down in terms of classification in terms of Section 28 of IPIT Act. Death cases is 4. Death in police custody is 4 cases. Death as a result of police action is 26 cases. Discharge of an official firearm is 17 cases. Assault is 25 cases. Torture is 2 cases. That gives a total of 74. And when you look at in terms of the province, those specific classification of cases, you'll note that Gauteng received 13 of these cases, 2 being death in police custody, 9 being death as a result of police action, and 2 being discharge of an official firearm. Whereas KZN, it was 2 death in police custody, 17 death as a result of police action, 15 discharge of an official firearm, 2 torture cases, 25 assault cases, and the total there is 61. And the totals is 4 death in police custody, 26 death as a result of police action, 17 discharge, 2 tortures, 25 assault, which results in 74 cases. With regard to cooperation and coordination in relation to the cases we investigate, I think SAPS and NPS report crime incidents resulting from police action as per their obligations in terms of Section 29 of the IPID Act. And SAPS and NPS give cooperation on cases referred to IPID for investigation. The exhibits were referred to forensic laboratory for analysis. Even though we have issues there in terms of the turnaround, as the NPA presentation was also indicating, postmortems were attended by IPID and were conducted by the Department of Health in various health institutions. With regard to challenges, Chairperson, we had challenges with regard to uncooperative witnesses. And as a result of the volatile situation, it was difficult for IPID to access some of the victims and witnesses. And the high intake in the unrest within a very short space of time was making it difficult to attend some of the crime scenes timeously. Other crime scenes were not attended immediately due to safety reasons, as police were also being attacked in certain communities, because we rely on the police to assist us, especially in accessing a crime scene where there is violence. There were cases of stampede where there are no witnesses and no details could be provided on those cases. In certain instances, there were shootings involving communities, the police, and private security making it difficult to ascertain who were responsible for the shooting. It was also difficult for IP to access crime scene during the unrest. The communities sometimes reluctant to cooperate with IP investigations for fear of being investigated by SAPS for their role in the lootings. On the impact of COVID, you know, investigation, Chairperson, we had situations where witnesses and complainants and other role players were not wearing masks or observing safety protocols. There was also issues of closure of some police stations and laboratories due to COVID reported cases. And there was also reluctance of witnesses to meet investigators due to COVID. Thanks, Chairperson. That is our presentation that covers the focus areas as requested by the committee. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you very much for that presentation. And I'm just going to take the cue by the Deputy Minister and just move straight to honourable members. Whether you have any questions for clarity and comments that you would want to make based on the presentation that we've received from IPES. Any honourable member would like to raise any questions? Honourable Nkosi, are you still on the platform? Honourable Nkosi? Okay, Honourable Bartlett, I see your hand is up. Perhaps I'll start with you. I know Honourable Nkosi has some questions based on the presentation. However, I don't see her. She is on the platform. Honourable Bartlett, let us start with yourself.
Okay, thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you very much. Chair, I have two questions with regards to slide 8. Even though the heading or the slide refers to lessons learned, Chair, the content seems to speak to the challenges. What levels of reflection did IPA done internally to reflect on how to manage situations like this differently in the future, and particularly in light of the challenges which have been identified? The committee is very much interested in understanding how IPAs will be more effective and responsive in the future should a similar situation like this one arise. In regard to the second question, Chair, on slide 8, it also mentions how difficult it has been to ascertain who was responsible for shootings in instances where the shootings involved the communities, the police, and the private security. What measures has IPED put in place to establish the levels of regard of responsibility in this regard? I thank you, Honourable Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Bartlett. Honourable Nkosi?
Chairperson, thank you very much. Let me greet the Honourable Deputy Minister and his entourage, and thank you very much for the presentation made. There are questions that I've noted when I was reading the presentation. Now, number one question, Chair, is with regards to the cases related to recent unrest, given the high number of deaths as a result of police action 25 and assault 26 and assault 25. What I want to know is to get the information as to how far are these investigations and what is the time frame for concluding these investigations. The other question that I have is in slide 6. The cooperation and coordination in terms of cases being investigated. Are there any challenges in relation to the cooperation between IPED, SAPS, and Metro Police Services? If so, please outline the challenges and lessons learned. The other question, what is the current level of cooperation with the NPA in respect of the cases under investigation by IPED? Are there any challenges or lessons to report to the committee in terms of this cooperation? My last question, Chair, is in slides, with regards to slide 7. Refer to the challenges experienced by IPED. What measures were undertaken to overcome these challenges? Were some of these challenges related to staffing and resources too? If so, please elaborate. Thank you very much, Chair. I submit.
Thank you very much, Honorable Nkosi. Are there any other honorable members? I'm not noting any hand that has been raised. Okay. Perhaps then just from my side, Deputy Minister and Executive Director, I wanted to know is IPED investigating any matters in which the police, be it SAPS or the Metro Police, participated in looting or were found in possession of items looted or stolen during the unrest? And secondly, just in terms of the use of live ammunition and the use of rubber bullets, are there any guidelines around these two, especially in unrest situations? Because I think in terms of the discharge of a firearm, does this only relate to live ammunition or does it also include rubber bullets? Maybe just clarity on that and whether, if it does not, what are the guidelines, especially in terms of the use of rubber bullets in unrest situations? Thank you very much, Deputy Minister, my apologies. If I can perhaps hand over to you to just direct how the responses will be dealt with. Deputy Minister.
No, thanks very much. I think I'll allow the Executive Director and the team to lead in the responses. Through you, Chair, the Executive Director.
Thank you very much, DM. Let me allow Mr. Sisoko to first respond to some of the questions that have been posed. I will also add to what he has already said. Over to Ntate Soko.
Thanks, Idia. Thanks, Chairperson and members. I'll strive to respond to the question to the best of my ability. The question in relation to what measures IP put in place to establish who is responsible. I think, honourable members, in relation to this specific situation of the unrest, we must indicate that it was very difficult for IPED. Firstly, members should take note that IPED is informed of these matters by SAPS as required in terms of Section 29 of IPED Act. And once a notification is made, IPED will then have to attend the crime scene. In order for IPED to attend the crime scene, IPED would engage with the police to assist in attending that crime scene, specifically in situation where there is violence in relation to that specific crime scene. So in most of these cases, there was violence, and based on the assessment made by the police also, it was difficult. And even when the IPED investigators approached the scene, it was difficult to get into the crime scene. So they had to wait for the police to try and clear those that were interfering with the crime scene so as to enable IPED to attend or to deal with that crime scene. Part of what we experience when attending the crime scene is that the crime scenes, most of them were destroyed by people who were there, the looters. So it was difficult, for instance, to even after it has been secured to get evidence like your cartridges, bullets and so forth on the crime scene. So it made it difficult from an investigative point of view. So that is the kind of challenges that we were met with. With regard to the questions of Honorable Nkosi, How far are these investigations and the time frames? The investigations are still at a very early stage, Honorable Nkosi, because we're still trying to piece together the evidence. We've also met in some instances with community leaders to try and establish who the witnesses could be, who can assist with the investigations, even within the challenge that we have of reluctance of people coming forward. So it therefore becomes difficult also to indicate the time frames for investigations. Some of the crime scenes, we have to reconstruct those crime scenes, but for us to enable us to reconstruct the crime scenes, we must get people who were there at the crime when the crime was committed to assist us to reconstruct the crime scene. So those are the issues that we are dealing with currently. So it therefore becomes difficult to indicate the time frame for these investigations. With regard to any challenges with cooperation, in this instance, we must indicate that we've had cooperation from the SAPS, as I've indicated. They are the ones also that reported these matters to us. What we do also is that when these when the investigations continues, we also encourage our investigators to liaise with the NPA so that to guide these investigations, especially in this kind of cases where we realize that it could be difficult to prove some of these cases because of the interference with the crime scenes that had happened. So that is what we do. What measures have we put in place undertaken to deal with these challenges? As I've indicated that we have engaged with community leaders to try and get assistance in identifying the witnesses that could assist in investigations. Unfortunately, as and when these crimes were committed and the crime scenes became alive, it was difficult to immediately attend because of the volatile nature of
recording stopped.
Of what was happening, and also with regard to where there are allegations of shooting by police and community members and the members of the private security. These are information that also came from the police to an extent that
recording in progress.
We could not even be able to say this could be a death as a result of police action. And until such time that there is enough information gathered that suggests that there were police involved, those are kind of cases that we could not even take on as cases that are within our mandate because there was no information that comes pointing out to involvement of the police, except information that came to say shootings happened from different people, and where we suspect there's indication that, or even where the police suspect that they themselves may have been responsible for the death, that's when those cases would be registered, and hence we have the 74 cases. So on the question, on your question, Chairperson, whether we're investigating any matter involving police where they were themselves involved in the looting, we have not received such a matter as we've indicated in the slide 4 and 5. Those are the only cases that came to our attention. We did pick up a video that there were allegations that members of the metro in Durban were involved in the looting. When I picked up that video, I immediately sent it to the acting provincial head for KZN. And when she followed up, it turned out that these were members who had confiscated looted stuff from the looters, and they were taking it to their police pounds. So it could not be accounted for as a looting by those members involved. So that was the only case that we became aware of. We have seen media and people saying there were those kind of instances where police themselves were involved, but nothing has been brought to our attention, Chair. On whether there are guidelines in relation to the use of live ammunition and rubber bullets. Chairperson, the first with the rubber bullets, the police normally use that to disperse a crowd, but they also have standing orders on how to use these rubber bullets. For instance, they can't shoot them at a close range, so there are distances where they must observe before they can shoot these rubber bullets. But that is the extent to which I know they can use these rubber bullets. And with regard to live ammunition, Chairperson, I think that is more provided for in terms of Section 49 of the Criminal Procedure Act, where they can use live ammunition and even kill to defend themselves or to defend others. So those are the circumstances where they are allowed to use live ammunition to defend themselves. There are specific police standing orders which then regulate especially this provision, so guide them in terms of these provisions of Section 49 in terms of how they must conduct themselves. And also on rubber bullets, I think there are standing orders also on how they should use them, especially your public order policy. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Soko. But in addition to what Mr. Soko has said, I must say the lessons that we've learned as IPIT was we realized that we do not have enough capacity as IPIT to be in all the places, especially in KZN, where this violence erupted in so many areas. And because of the limited capacity that we had, we could not be everywhere the way we wanted to. But what we are currently planning was to have offices in different districts so that our own investigators must be stationed there. And in the event that there are such unrest in future, it is easy to access IPIT in those different districts. Already we have negotiated or engaged with the Department of Community Safety in KZN to then assist us in getting those satellite offices. And the discussion is already at the final stage where offices will be given to us. We're just waiting for them to then indicate which districts are we going to be occupying those offices. But the other issue is around forensics. Unfortunately, we'll always delay because we are technical reports will be delayed because we are dependent on SAPS as well as the Department of Health to assist us in giving us those technical reports. Hence, we always have this challenge in terms of saying what is our turnaround time because we are dependent on other institutions beyond us. But what we have also done during this period of unrest, Chairperson and members, was to have engagement in different community radio stations. And I must commend those community radio stations because there was one community radio station where I went to and people were indicating to us that some of the officers have the goods that have been looted. And fortunately, on the spot, immediately after we've been interviewed, I then called different station commanders and they assisted with arresting some of those members in police stations such as you ever done as well as a chairperson. So yeah, I think that's chairperson that we can share with the select committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Executive Director. Honourable members, do you have any follow-up that you would want to make? Okay. If not,
I have, Chair.
Honourable Matamai, are you asking a question?
Yes, I just want to ask to make a follow-up on the question that was asked.
Okay, please go ahead.
I don't know how to use this thing.
We can hear you, Honourable Matamai.
Okay.
You may.
There is some cases. I just want to know because it seems to me on IP there are cases that are being committed by the police in our police force. Maybe we are having two different police. The senior white police officers that being assault people. And when you go and check about those cases, they are not being charged by the IP. Even though the case are still in IP, they will take more than 7 to 8 months and still waiting for the cases to be prosecuted or those people be charged. What makes so difficult for them not to charge the senior police officers who committed crime, assaulting people, or is because these police officers, they are seniors, they cannot be prosecuted. I just want to know, there are 3 cases that I have that I can bring their people before there, especially in Mafatsani police station, Everton police station, they call it Mafatsani, where they're being assaulted people, there's a man who assault people there and he cannot be prosecuted. I want to know what makes them so difficult for them to prosecute that man. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Matamai. I don't know, Executive Director, if you have the information that Honourable Matamai is raising, but perhaps you could just respond to whether senior officials within the SAPS, whether they're being treated with soft gloves or not or what, but yeah, maybe respond to that. Perhaps even if you're not familiar with the cases that Honourable Matamai is referring to, I think that information can, we'll request Honourable Matamai to provide it to you. Executive Director?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think, yes, we will definitely need those cases that Honourable Matamai is talking about so that we can just check what is the status on those cases. But I think Mr. Sisoko, as the head, will also delve deeper on the matter where we have charged senior officers and we're still dealing with those cases. Maybe Ntate Soko, can you elaborate further on that matter?
Thanks, Eddie. Thanks, Chair and Honourable Members. Honourable Matamai, as IPED, we conduct our investigations without fear, favour or prejudice. It doesn't matter the level of a member who is involved in the alleged criminality. You may be aware that we have a number of cases that are before courts where generals are being charged. So we don't choose who to charge, but we deal with all the cases based on the evidence that we have. It doesn't matter whether it's a senior white officer or a black officer, that does not play any role. We investigate our cases, we present them to the NPA, who then decide to charge, and then those people will be charged. So one of the issues that the honorable members must be made aware of, and we've discussed this also at this committee level, also at the PCT, that because of our capacity constraints, as IPED, we've got very limited capacity, very few investigators, and lots of cases that we have to deal with. So given that kind of a challenge, we took a policy position that we will then prioritize cases. That does not mean we won't be investigating other cases, but we prioritize them. And in terms of prioritization of our cases, our first priority goes to cases of death in police custody, death as a result of police action, your GBV cases, like your rape cases, your torture cases, and your corruption cases. And then all the other cases then come after that in terms of priority. So as and when we prioritize, we also try to get our investigators, as they investigate the priority cases, they try to get to these other cases that are not priority cases, like your common assault, for instance. So it may take a bit longer for us to investigate some of these cases because of those kind of challenges. But ultimately, we get to all the cases. And as long as we've got evidence, people will be charged. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Deputy Minister, would you have any final comments that you would like to make?
No, thanks, Chair. I'm happy with the responses that the Executive Director and Mr. Sissoko gave. Indeed, Chair, we investigate any case that comes to our table, irrespective of who is involved. And I would like to support the Executive Director and Mr. Sissoko that Mr. Mutsamai must give us the case that he's talking about involving an officer in Ivatech. And that Executive Director, that case, we should get it, and we must come back to the NCOP committee to give a feedback around that case. Because there is nothing that we want to hide. And the South Africans must know that they can rely on IPED. And we can only do so if we deal with issues openly that, like, for example, are raised in this platform, that we should come back to you, Chair, and the committee, and report the progress with regard to this specific case of Everton. Because, you know, we might end up thinking that senior officers or white officers are not made to account on the things that they do. I must say that on some of the questions that were raised earlier on, Mr. Sissoko appropriately responded to, particularly the one that was involving Metro Police, because I did see that video myself of them taking loading goods into their kumbi. Indeed, those were stolen goods which were confiscated by the officers, and they were taking them to the place where they store stolen goods. To date, there is no police officer or Metro Police officer who was engaged in the looting. Any officer that could have participated in the looting, and it came to our attention, that officer, I can assure you that we're going to take appropriate steps against such officers. But if there are officers that indeed were involved and we were not aware of, we will urge members to give us those information so that we act on those cases. The other issues, I think I'm happy with the responses that were given, particularly around the usage of rubber bullets and leave ammunition. And I think Mr. Sissoko appropriately outlined those issues, because what members must understand, for instance, is that rubber bullets kill depending on the distance from which it is discharged. And I think he explained that very appropriately, and I'm happy with that. What I can assure members, Chair, is that we have made sure that there is a proper or appropriate relationship between the South African Police Service and the Independent Police Investigative Directorate led by the Executive Director. As we speak, they have signed an agreement which is going to guide how they work at the senior level between the National Commissioner and the Executive Director. There is a good working relationship. And even below her, there are teams that have been put there to work to, so that they work together. But this does not suggest that we won't have contradictions or conflict between the police and the executives and the IP. You will have those because primarily IP is the police of the police. So the police, while the police everybody, IP police them. And definitely there will be instances where IP is going to act. And when they act, they arrest them. And I've never seen anybody who, when they are arrested, they smile and say, "Hi, arrest me and take to prison." There is some kind of resistance, be it police officers or ordinary South Africans. So their relationship is that one of cooperation and but also contradictory. But it helps because if IP is experiencing certain challenges around cooperation from the side of the police, the executive director can pick up a call and interact with the national commissioner to straighten whatever misunderstanding is there. So we are working together. IPED is doing its job. Yes, they are challenged, like it has been said, around personnel, but with what they have, they are able to execute their mandate. But thanks once more, Chairperson and the members of the committee for affording us an opportunity to account to the provinces, since this is a platform where provincial interests are attended to. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister. And I think with regard to the Everton case, Honourable Matsumai, if you need assistance to get it to the IPED, I think my office can assist you. But thank you very much, Deputy Minister, Executive Director, and the team from IPED for your presentation, as well as your responses to the questions that were posed by members. I think you have given us a much clearer picture of the levels of misconduct which took place during the unrest, as well as the challenges being encountered during the investigations. We hope to receive a further report, as indicated by the Minister of Continuous Progress Report. But I think we are very much interested in the recommendations that are made by IPED, but more so the actions that get undertaken in respect of the recommendations that they make. And we further wish to encourage IPED to work closely with the relevant departments within the JCPS cluster to strengthen and foster relationships and to ensure the successes of their investigations. Once again, thank you very much, Deputy Minister. Thank you very much, Executive Director. And thank you very much, Mr. Sissoko, for this briefing. And honorable members, for your questions, as well as your attendance in this process. I think we have received a very important and very relevant information. Deputy Minister, thank you. And I'm going to declare this meeting closed. Honourable members, I'm aware that in the next 4 minutes, we have to get into another meeting. So thank you very much. This meeting is hereby declared closed.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate a minute.
Sure.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable members.
Thank you, Chair.
Recording stopped.
Yes, let's see in the meeting.
Thank you, Deputy Minister.
And thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Chair.